Hello and welcome to another edition of Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to embrace all aspects of talking about death and dying and make sure it's not a taboo that's hidden under the carpet all the time. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Jane Harris of the Good Grief Project. She's going to tell us all about how she started it off. It seems to be a wonderful resource for people, Jane, but as with so many of these things, it has a very tragic beginning, doesn't it?
Yes. Sadly, our beautiful son Joshua died in 2011, and we were thrown into a very different world where no parent ever believes that, you know, they're going to outlive their child. It's all back to front. I'm a therapist. My husband is a filmmaker. Together we make films. So I'm kind of used to working with grief. But when you live the experience, it's very, very different from the theory. And so I might say I'm probably a much better therapist than I was back then. But the point is, our world was turned upside down. Josh was having the time of his life. He was 22. He was a young producer for the Ministry of Sound. That was his dream job. He was settling in. He'd taken a few months out to go traveling in Vietnam. And he was in a road accident and died instantly. And so, you know, we got that knock on the door that, you know, nobody can ever imagine what it's like to receive. And two very inexperienced police people came in and told us they didn't really know how to do it. They didn't have the tools or the skills. And in the blink of an eye, our worlds were very different. So we had to pick ourselves up. We had to carry on. We were lucky enough to have other children. There's a lot of bereaved people parents who don't. And, you know, when you have other kids, I can speak personally, it kind of keeps you going. You have to kind of keep going. Saying that, our daughter was 18 at the time. My other son was living in London, my stepson. He came home immediately. And we all kind of sat together and tried to think what we were going to have to do. And of course, we're going to have to organize a funeral. And that's the last thing we wanted to do. But we had the sort of realization that, yeah, we're going to have to organize a funeral. So we thought, let's try and make this into something useful. As filmmakers, we thought, and this is not for most people, I have to say, but as filmmakers, we knew we were probably going to make a film about it.
Thank you. That quick, you realised.
Yes, and that's on our website, which I'll tell you about later. But basically, the film we made is called Beyond Goodbye, and it was our way of capturing the essence of the celebration of Josh's life that we created with his friends. And I suppose it's important to say all his friends were 22. They hadn't really experienced grief, thank heavens, or death. Some of them had, but most of them hadn't. And when we asked them if they'd take part and contribute, they said, no, we can't. It's going to be too upsetting. And we said, look, you know, we're all in this together. It's going to be upsetting, but together we can do this. And so out of that came the most remarkable celebration of his life, which lasted all day. And from what I can understand, it was very therapeutic for everybody, because when somebody dies abroad or it's a very sudden, unexpected death, you don't get to say goodbye. Mm. So we created a ritual. We created this event. People sang, they read poems. And the film Beyond Goodbye, when I look at it now, I look back on it now, it's a remarkably beautiful gathering with a huge amount of laughter in it, which you would not expect. And when I look at the film, and I really would suggest people who feel up to it to look at it, it's not a film that brings you down. It's uplifting. You see these young people all laughing and cheering and talking about Josh, sharing jokes. And at the end of it, we asked a few people what it had meant to them, and we asked ourselves, and it was our way of saying goodbye. So from very early on, we realized the importance of ritual, of photography, of an active, intentional, proactive grief. And that's kind of where we started off in terms of setting up the charity, the Good Grief Project, because we realized very soon, a year after, you know, after the funeral, everybody goes back to their ordinary lives. And they expected us to. And I'm sure you, if you've had any experience of grief, will know that, as anyone listening will, that After the funeral's over, people think you're going to become your old self again. Everything's back to normal. Well, it's the beginning of a long, beastly, challenging journey. And I personally felt the second year was worse than the first because everybody had moved on and we were left behind. And we didn't know what to do. So we had some ideas and we thought, let's go and make a film. Let's go for a road trip. Our last holiday with our Josh was in America. We spent Christmas there. We did a house swap in New York. Let's go on a road trip across America, which sounds a bit mad, and we'll film and we'll interview bereaved parents and siblings. And that's what we did. And out of that came a film called A Love That Never Dies, another film. And the clues in the title, A Love That Never Dies, you know, we knew, as anyone who's lost a child or a loved one suddenly or unexpectedly, that your love doesn't, your grief, you don't get over it and your love doesn't die. You know, it carries on, but people don't necessarily have the tools to practice or internalize the model of continuing bonds, which for us is at the heart of our charity. And continuing bonds, for people who don't know, is actually a really straightforward idea. You fold the person into your heart and you carry them forward. You don't get over it. There's no time frame, there's no rules. You learn to do that. Now, when someone's traumatized and they've suddenly been bereaved, if you were to tell them that, they'd probably tell you to, yeah. But point being, it's now 2025 and we've learned so much and we've run retreats for bereaved parents and siblings twice a year. And this is the model that we use. And it's not, it sounds like magical thinking, but it's not. It's basically finding the tools and the skills, I suppose, through simple creative acts. It can be, you don't need to be an artist or an author, through creative writing, through exercise, through, you know, there's many different ways. You can actually learn to carry your person with you. So you don't get over it, but you do, you can learn to live with it, but it isn't easy, and grief is a beast.
Gosh, Jane, there's so much there I want to pick up and talk to you about. But the last thing you've just been talking about, this carrying them forward, it's kind of involuntary anyway, isn't it? Because, I mean, I'm 3 years on down the line now. People expect me to be over it. But my husband is in my mind and my heart, 95% of the day.
Well, firstly, what I would say to you is 3 years is nothing, and I'm so sorry for the death of your husband, but 3 years is early, early days. And a lot of people in those first few years can't imagine. They believe that they might forget or they might lose the sound of that person's voice. It's very scary. And people often liken grief to anxiety. You know, it's a very awful knotted feeling in the pit of your stomach. You carry it. Grief brain is a thing. People forget. And there's some wonderful books about that. We won't go into that, but there are some wonderful writing about that. But the point is that it's not obvious. And people who come on our retreats are reluctant to talk about their child, whether it's 2 years, 5 years. We had one person come who was in her 80s, registered blind, hadn't grieved for her 50-year-old son, and just came along on the basis that, well, nothing was working. She may as well give it a try. And she came with a carer. And by the end of the retreat, she said to us, you know what? I think I've got a few years left in me. I was just hoping to die. But actually, she took part in the workshops, the boxing workshops, the creative writing workshops, the photography workshops. She created new memories out of old photos. And I suppose the societal pressure that we all feel when we're bereaved is be strong. Pull yourself together. Don't upset people. It's really difficult to find a space where you can take that mask off and just get into it and laugh or cry, whatever it is, or be angry, because grief can be very angry. But on the whole, these expressions are not really welcomed. And so it's just giving people the tools, I think. And we found the tools on the basis of our previous lives. There's life before Josh died and there's life after Josh died. And we've used those to, I suppose, enable people. We've used our lived experience to enable people to move forward at a time in their lives when they think, I'm just going to sit this out now. Everything's lost. What's the point? Yeah.
So you're kind of advocating doing rather than being.
Absolutely. So the heart of our work at the Good Grief Project, which is a charity we set up with the help of the Winston Churchill Fellowship, it is a charity, and it's run on the basis that we basically fund anyone who wants to come on our retreats to attend a residential weekend retreat, which is all about active, intentional pursuits. And nobody's excluded. Those who pay, pay more. Those who can't pay, don't pay. But the point is that it gives everyone an opportunity to look at an active, intentional way of processing your grief, where you opt in. You don't sit back and wait, because so many people drown in the dark space, the dark times in their early grief. It offers a kind of network. It's a peer-to-peer support, I suppose, that's terribly helpful. And I think that intentional approach is very enabling. And certainly the feedback from our retreats is, you know, I felt better. I laughed again. I didn't pretend. I didn't worry that if I told someone I was a bereaved parent that they'd faint on the spot. Because however well-intentioned people are, it's very hard for people to sit with somebody who's lost a child. And that's the key. Sit with it. Don't fix it. And you'll know that yourself. When people try and fix it, you want to say to them, whoa, 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 I know you're trying to help, but please just sit. And Catherine Mannix is a wonderful example of somebody who's, she's written a book called Listen. And it's all about sitting alongside people, listening. And she wrote the introduction to the book that we wrote 10 years on after Josh died, which is our handbook to grief and all our learning. And she wrote the introduction for us, which is an amazing honour.
If there's one lesson I've learned from doing 66, 67 episodes now of this podcast, is that we don't give people enough space and time to talk about their grief or their lost loved one. But we also, most people don't know how to do it. And so they don't even try. So they say nothing. And that, I think, is probably one of the hardest things that bereaved people have to go to, the fact that they feel their loss is not being acknowledged after, as you say, quite a short time, actually.
Absolutely right. And, you know, part of the work of our charity, the Good Grief Project, is going and giving talks to the police or to big organisations after a member of staff has died either by an accident or even suicide, to support the team and suggest in a very conversational way. We make these talks very accessible, that, you know, basically sitting with and trying to just deal with your own anxiety is one of the most important things you can do for people who are suffering. And that is not easy. And as a therapist, forget grief, as a therapist, you have to learn to do that in your training. Years and years and years of training, all about sitting with. Don't jump in. Don't say, oh, I know how you feel, or maybe they're in a better place. Oh, you get over it. Don't start me. But the point is to sit with in silence and say, I don't know how you feel, but my heart goes out to you. Or I'm going to try and help if I can, but do tell me if something I say doesn't work. Or, you know, it's very difficult to do that.
Being comfortable with silence is impossible for some people, isn't it?
It is. And yet, if you give them some tools to do that, they can, I think, if they want to. When people say, how can I help? You say, well, do you actually really want to help? Or would you rather just take a step off to the left or to the right or to the side? Because a lot of people think they want to help, but actually they want to run for the hills.
Yes, and they want you to be better.
Yeah, I don't blame them. But in my early years of grief, I knew I was angry. I've lost quite a few friends. Your address book changes fundamentally. And some of those people come back and some of them don't. But what I will say is I've met the most remarkable people in the years since our son died that I would never have met. Bereaved parents whose courage is incredible. Bereaved siblings who are the forgotten mourners who never really get to talk about their grief because they're so busy worrying about their parents' grief. Yeah. Our kids felt like that. They are now part of our charity. Our son runs the active side. Our daughter, who's a film producer in London, she basically cooks the food for everyone who comes on the retreat. It's her way of honouring her brother. And I suppose, you know, they may have hated our openness about Josh's death, but what they say to us now is that it's given us the tools to grieve. It's given them the knowledge and the understanding, and they step up and they can support siblings who've been bereaved. So it's hard, isn't it? Because you want to kind of move on and park it, but that doesn't work. You can't really park grief. It won't go away. It's a bit, as I said earlier, a bit of a beast.
And what you just said about your children and sibling help and what you said yourself about other parents, that's something else that's come up for me during all these podcasts, is that anyone who's been bereaved wants to find their tribe. Somebody called it their tribe. People who've been through a similar thing. It'll never be the same thing, but a similar thing, so that they can understand a bit more than someone who's lost a different relative or a different friend or whatever.
That's right. I think that's the enormous power of peer-to-peer support. It's immeasurable. And to sit alongside someone who has lived experience that is similar to you is very, very special. It cuts right through. It, in a way, it doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, what your history is. It cuts through everything to the nub of the kind of grief experience. And you can talk in a way as if you've known them forever, but you've only just met. And time again, that's been reinforced for us on our retreats for bereaved parents and siblings.
Now, the other thing you said really early on that I wanted to pick up on is the business about turning it into a film, the funeral into a film, lots of laughter and all the rest of it. So you've got a record, haven't you? You've got something to go back to and look at, which most of us don't have, because yeah. I was only discussing this with one of my children the other day. Nobody gets their smartphones out during a funeral, do they? It seems to be the one time when smartphones are not allowed in society. So we look back and we think, well, we haven't got a record of anything that happened like that. And it probably would have been a good idea to have a photographer, but it's not part of the accepted ritual or routine of funerals yet, is it?
No. So in 2011, what we were doing was fairly radical. And, you know, we said, look, we're going to be filming this. We're going to be taking photographs. We always have and we always will. If you're not happy, step aside. This is Joshua's memorial celebration of his life. Let us know if you don't want to be in anything that we create. People didn't do that then. They do it a lot more now. It's you know, it is kind of 14 years on, isn't it? However, it's an unusual, people find it, I suppose, voyeuristic, but of course it's not. It's cathartic, it's therapeutic. But you know, we have parents who come on our retreats who don't have films, who don't have videos, who don't have anything except maybe one photograph. They bring that one photograph. And out of that photograph, we enable them to create another photograph in the moment. So this idea of creating new memories, you might do a montage, a collage. You wouldn't believe the beauty of the photographs that people create. And in fact, we're doing another book about continuing bonds and photography, because there is magic in there. And our first book, When Words Are Not Enough, is all about photography, because sometimes words are not enough. The photography is a way of helping people tune into grief without having to necessarily read anything. You can pick up a book and look at images. You can pick up a photograph. When people are in the early stages of grief, or even later, grief brain is very difficult to concentrate, isn't it? And I think we thought, if we could make a photographic book which integrates theory, practice, 13 other people's experiences, not just bereaved parents, it's actually husbands, wives, daughters, part, you know, it's a book about grief in all its forms, but it's every person's story is about an intentional way that they used their skill, whatever it was, to remember and create new memories. So it might be an artist or somebody was using flower arranging to create new memories. You know, it could be any number. Swimming, actually, exercise. Swimming was another very, very important part of it. And the active part of our retreats is about being in the moment, a sort of dual process model of grief, where you can almost park your grief, immerse yourself in something else, and then go back to it. Give yourself a permission to have some respite without guilt. Give yourself permission to laugh without guilt. Give yourself permission to eat something nice without guilt. And that might sound very strange to people who aren't bereaved, but bereaved people know what I mean when I say that, I think.
And grief and laughter do kind of go side by side, don't they? It's very weird. It sounds weird to most people probably to say that, but there is something, I don't know what it is, heightened emotion or something. You seem to go through both in parallel.
If you were to hover above one of our residential grief retreats, you might think it was a party or a birthday. You wouldn't think it was a retreat of bereaved parents and siblings. Because the laughter, the relief to be able to laugh and use dark humour and to share is enormous. Take the mask off, you know, and actually laugh and cry. And a lot of men on the retreats cry from beginning to end because they didn't want to be there. A lot of the men, there's many more women come on our retreats than men, and we're encouraging men to come because for them it's really hard. And I know I'm making generalizations, but really what I would say is the men who come on our retreats are so relieved that they have. And because our team is made up of Josh's dad, Josh's brother, myself and his sister, 50% of us, men, women, and that makes a difference. We model families grieving together where men and women take equal responsibility.
Sounds wonderfully therapeutic, Jane. And because you've been doing it for so long, you must have some really good advice to pass on. I think really I'm asking on behalf of people who haven't been bereaved how to handle. If your next door neighbour has just lost a child, say, what's the best thing to do and to say? I mean, you did touch on it earlier on and you talked about saying nothing if that's the most comfortable. But how would you begin?
Well, to be really brutal, I would say to the person, try and get over yourself. Try and think of the bereaved person. Try and pluck up the courage just to knock on the door and say, I'm so sorry, or to message them, or actually just a postcard. I'm so sorry. I'm really thinking of you. A tiny gesture like that is so much better than holding it in and then years later thinking, I wish I'd knocked on the door or said something. Find ways to get over your own fear of grief. Read books. There's so many books out there. Watch films. I think it's not okay to say, oh, I want to help, but I don't want to intrude. I no longer am polite about that. I say to people, well, if you really want to help, you might have to skill yourself up a little bit and go and do something about it. And then not to put pressure on around timeframes or rules, because everybody grieves differently. Myself and my husband grieved completely differently, completely differently. That doesn't mean to say there isn't space for our relationship, but you have to work at it. You really do. Grief doesn't just sit there passively. You have to embrace it and work with it because, as I said, I've said two or three times, it's pretty beastly grief and it's like wearing a heavy backpack. And unless you unpack the content, it will affect your health, your mental health, your physical health, your well-being, your family, as it gets more and more repressed. So don't do that to yourself. I don't think anyone should do that to themselves. And if friends really want to support bereaved people, then step up without being intrusive. But you just make sure that, you know, people know that you're there and that, you know, it's I mean, a lot of couples, relationships, it's too challenging after the death of a child. But I would also say that for a lot of couples, it strengthens their relationship. There's a myth that all couples who lose a child split up, and that is not helpful because that is putting a lot of pressure on the couple. You know, on top of everything else, doctors will often say, oh, well, if you lose a child, your relationship might split up. And you think, oh, my God. Well, frankly, it all takes work. Couples need to work. They need to give space to each other. They need to, I suppose, just allow the unpredictability in and allow each other to grieve differently. And that is very, very challenging. And I think a lot of couples find that they feel so isolated in their grief and in their relationship and in their families. The silence gets deafening. And that's why we make films, because the hope is people can watch a film, read a book and think, okay, maybe. Just maybe we can get through this.
Jane, it's been lovely talking to you, but I don't want to let you go. I want you to tell me all about all the resources that you previously mentioned. So how can people find you? What are all the books and films called again? I know you've mentioned them once, but let's do it all over again.
Well, I suppose the simplest way to find our work is to go onto our website. Shall I give you the link?
Yeah.
It's www.thegoodgriefproject.co.uk. And on our website, there's headings of our films, our books, our retreats, our podcasts, our talks. It's all in there. And of course, people can write to us at info@thegoodgriefproject.co.uk. We write back. Our retreats run twice a year in May and September. They're always fully booked, but if people are interested, they can write to us and we will send information. Everybody has access. We make sure the charity is run on the basis that we raise money so that people can attend regardless of their finances.
And you're in the West Country.
We're based in Devon, but the charity, it's a tiny charity with a massive reach. We have people travelling from all over the world to attend our retreats. We've had people from Canada, France, Spain, because they can't find what we offer. If you put in active and retreat, up comes our Good Grief Project. But yeah, the retreats run twice a year. And they're basically built around the idea of creative writing, physical exercise, photography, good food, beautiful environment, comfortable location. We take over a whole very beautiful building for exclusive use, and that's where we run the retreats from Fridays till Sunday. Our book, When Words Are Not Enough, is available from Amazon. It's an ebook as well. It's available at discount from our publisher, and it's basically a handbook of 10 years of learning. So it uses photography, it incorporates theory, our own experiences, but the experiences of partners, of daughters, of all sorts of people talking about their grief and how being active and intentional has helped them to move forward at a time when they thought maybe they couldn't.
Thank you very much for sharing all that with us and for all the wonderful work that you do. Thank you, Jane.
Pleasure.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.